from having been seen for so long by so many. I don't have to tell you the cosmology, it's simple. He would grow stronger and stronger the more he appeared. I was confused, however, on every other score. For example, why did he not let the priests bring him to life in gold and walk in gold, the god himself about the city? Of course, I'd never heard of any god doing that, but then I'd never met a god before Marduk. He read these thoughts for me. He still looked apprehensive. Azrael, first off, the priests are not strong enough to make me solid and visible in gold. They cannot move the statue. They cannot make an image of me in gold, as you can, and then make it walk. They don't have the power. They don't have your gift. And even if they did, what would be my life? An endless New Year's festival surrounded by worshippers? I've seen gods fall for this. And in the end, they have nothing. They belong to everyone who can touch their garments or their skin or their hair. And they flee into the fog, finally screaming like the confused dead. No, such a thing I would only do if Babylon needed it of me, and Babylon does not. But Babylon needs something, and soon. And you know why. Cyrus the Persian, I said. He draws closer every day. He'll sack Babylon, and... I said, he will either slaughter my people with all the inhabitants, or he will maybe let us stay. Marduk put his arm around me, and we walked bravely through the enormous crowd that had gathered to stare at us and our strange activities. And we went on into another great garden, one of my favorites, where the musicians were always playing the harps. In fact, here the Hebrews played their music, and the Hebrew men often gathered to dance. I hadn't meant to come to my people directly, but as it turned out, it didn't matter. He said quite quickly, Azrael, I think we took the wrong turn. Why, they won't notice us any more than anyone else. They see me with a rich man. I'm a merchant. I'll say I sold you your beautiful girdle of gold and these jewels. He laughed at that, but he made us sit down together, and we were once again whispering. What do you know about the Persians? He asked me. What do you know about the cities that Cyrus conquers? What do you know? Well, I know the lies the Persians spread, that Cyrus brings peace and prosperity and leaves the people alone. But I don't believe it. He is a murdering king like any other. He is on the march like Assurbanipal. I don't believe the Persians will peacefully accept the surrender of this city. Who would believe them, do you? I realized that he was no longer listening to me. He pointed ahead. This is what I meant, he said, when I said we took the wrong turn. But they would have found us anyway. Be calm. Say nothing. Give away nothing. I saw what he saw, a great mass of the Hebrew elders storming towards us, clearing back the crowd and thickening it on all sides. And at the head of this crowd was the prophet Enoch, in a fury with his white hair streaming in all directions. And he gazed on Marduk, and I knew he saw Marduk, whereas all those around him, uneasy and unsure, and not wanting to provoke a riot, only saw a nobleman and their slightly crazy Azrael, whom they already knew to be a troublemaker of a mild, powerful, and obedient sort. Marduk looked the prophet in the eye. So did I. He came to a halt not far from us. He was half-naked, as prophets often are. He was covered with ashes and dirt, and he carried a staff. And I knew for the first time since I had ever heard of him—he wasn't a favorite of mine—that he was a real prophet because of the way he beheld Marduk with flaming indignation and violent faith. "You!" he declared, lifting his staff and pushing it at Marduk. The crowd fell back in fear. I mean, this figure did look like a rich man. But then the most terrible of all things happened. The prophet opened wide his eyes and said, "Bring to yourself your loot, the gold that your soldiers took from our temple in Jerusalem. Clothe yourself with it, you stupid, useless idol. Go on, you were made to be metal." And before I could think to act, the gold did come down upon Marduk and enclose him. But he resisted it, and I tried to banish it, and between us we made it a light covering only, and it did not have the deep vitality of the visions I had so long had. but the gold was all over Marduk, and the streets were filled with the sounds of running feet. I looked up at the distant houses that enclosed the garden, and the rooftops were thronged with onlookers. My father suddenly pushed his way to the fore and threw his arm in front of Enoch. "You hurt us with this, don't you see?" he declared. And then he too saw Marduk standing there, now dusted with gold, and Enoch hit my father with his staff. I was enraged, but my brothers surrounded the prophet, and Marduk took my arm. "Stay with me," he said, imploringly in a soft whisper. "Am I all gold?" I explained he was covered over with it, and it was getting thicker, but he was not the moving idol that he had seemed to me at first. He merely smiled, and he looked up at the people on the rooftops and turned round and round, and people began to scream. "Silence!" shouted Enoch, stamping the bricks with his staff, his beard shuddering. You should have seen him. He was in his glory. I tell you, prophets are murderous, a murderous breed. "You, Marduk, god of Babylon, are nothing but an impostor sent out from the temple," he roared. Marduk laughed under his breath. "Well, he's giving us a way out, Azrael. What a relief." "Do you want them to believe in you, my lord? All you need to do is vanish and reappear. I'll help you." He gave me a devastating look. "I know," I said, "I disappoint you. You don't want to be the god."
"Who in the hell would want it, Azrael?"
"No, I shouldn't say that. Let me say, who would give up life for it? But there's no time. Your prophet here before us is about to bellow like a bull." And Enoch did just that. He raised his powerful voice, though how such a thunder could have come from such a scrawny ribcage it's hard to imagine, and he declared,
"Babylon, your time is come. You will be humbled. Even as we speak, the Anointed One comes, Cyrus the Persian, the scourge whom the Lord God Yahweh has sent to punish you for what you have done to his chosen people, and to lead us back to our own land."
Roars came from the Hebrews, roars and prayers and chants and bowing to the Lord God of hosts, and the Babylonians looked on in amazement, some of them even laughing. And then Enoch made his prophecy again.
"Yahweh sends a Savior in the person of Cyrus to save this city. I, even you, Babylon, you yourself will be delivered out of the hands of mad Nabonidus into the hands of a liberator."
There was a beat of silence, only a beat. And then the roar rose from all, Hebrew, Babylonian, Greek, Persian. The whole crowd cried up for joy.
"Yes, yes, the Anointed One, Cyrus the Persian, may he liberate us from a mad king who has left the city."
Hordes began to bow to Marduk, bow at his feet and stretch out their arms and then back away.
"All right, impostor, savor your moment," cried Enoch. "It is the will of Yahweh that your city be surrendered without bloodshed. But you are no true god. You are an impostor, and in the temples there are naught but statues. Statues, I tell you. You and your priests will see us leave in triumph, and you will thank us that we have saved Babylon for you."
I was truly speechless, no joke. I couldn't figure this out. But Marduk only nodded his head and took the insults of the prophet. And then he turned and threw up his arms. "I'm leaving you now, Azrael, but take care and do nothing until you have my advice. Be on guard against those you love, Azrael. I feel dread, not for Babylon. Babylon shall conquer, but for you. Now comes my moment of pride." He then began to blaze with gold light, and I could see by his maddened eyes that it was coming from him. And as the Babylonians and the Jews saw it, he had the strength from them to grow brighter, and then he said in a huge voice, more huge than a man's, and rattling the lattices and echoing off the buildings,
"Get away from me, Enoch and all your tribe! I forgive you your rash words. Your god is faceless and merciless, but I call down the wind now to scatter you all!"
And the wind came. The wind came with huge ferocity over the rooftops, lifted off the desert and filled with sand. The gold figure of Marduk suddenly grew immense before me, but I knew now this was illusion, for it was paling. And as I stood looking up at him, He exploded into a shower of gold, and the people went completely wild. Everyone ran. Panic drove them. What they had seen drove them. What they had heard, and, if nothing else, the wind salted with sand drove them. Only I stood there, my brothers now rushing to my side, and the prophet Enoch, laughing, just laughing and throwing out his arms. Then he bore down on me, shoving my father to one side with his staff. He gave me the evil eye. He looked at me and he said, "You will pay for eating the food of the false gods. You will pay. You will pay." And he spat at me, and reached down for the sand that was gathered and threw it at me. My brothers begged him to stop, but he laughed, and he said, "You will pay." I got furious, truly furious. My happy nature left me. I felt the first anger that would soon become common to me after my death. I leant forward and I said, "Call on Yahweh to stop this sandstorm, you fool!" And then my brothers literally dragged me away. A host of devoted elders rushed out to shelter Enoch, and they picked him up and carried him away like a madman, thrashing and screaming, and gradually, as we ran to the shelter of our own house, the wind died away. Chapter 4. I was almost sick by the time we reached the house. My brothers were carrying me. And outside the gate, what should we see? First were two of the other prophets, the more quiet ones who merely echoed the old words of Jeremiah sent from Egypt, and with them an old woman whom everyone feared and despised. Her name was Asenath, and she was one of our tribe, but she was a necromancer, everybody knew, and such things were forbidden, whether the great king Saul had ever called up Samuel with the witch of Endor or not. Also, everybody went to her for help from time to time. So, you know, it wasn't so great to see her outside our gate. But she had known my mother and my grandparents, and she wasn't the enemy, just someone with an unsavory reputation who could mix up poisons to kill people and potions to make people fall in love. She had straggling hair, very white, and eyes which had turned a perfect brighter blue with age, rather than pale, and a withered long face and a great triumphant expression. And she wore all scarlet, defiant scarlet, silks all over her, as if she were some Egyptian whore or something. And she carried a crooked staff with a snake on the end of it, not so unlike the staffs of the prophets. And she said to me, "Azrael, you come to me, or you let me in." By this time all the household was in the courtyard inside screaming and yelling at her to get away from our house, old witch, and my brothers told her to go. But to my surprise, my father said, "Come inside, Asenath, come inside." Next, I remember lying on my bed and listening to people talk. My brothers wanted to know how in the hell I had gotten into this, and how could I believe this demon was Marduk when he was obviously a demon, and why had I not told them that I was conversing with other gods? My sisters kept saying, "Oh, leave him alone," and for a moment I thought I saw the ghost of my mother. But this might have been a dream. All the uncles and elders were gathered in the long rooms of the scriptoria, which flanked the courtyard for half its distance. It was quite big, as I told you. And I didn't know where my father was. At last he sent for me, and my brother propped me up, and got me on my feet and took me to him. I didn't like the door through which we passed. This was a small antechamber off the chamber of the ancestors, that is, the little room in which earlier Assyrians and Akkadians of this very house had buried their dead. This little room was part of their old pagan worship, and we had never cleaned the paintings of priests and priestesses and ancestors of other people off the walls. Superstition stopped us, and after all, heathens that they were, their bones lay under the floor. There were three chairs in the room, simple chairs, you know the kind, of leather and crossed painted legs. But they were our very finest. And also there were three lampstands, and in each the wick was burning the olive oil brightly, so the room had a splendid but frightening look. Old Asenath sat in one chair, and my father in the other, and they were whispering, which they stopped when I came in. I sat down in the free chair, and my brothers left us, and there we were among painted Assyrians, in the flicker of these lamps, in an airless place. I closed my eyes. I opened them. I deliberately tried to see the dead. I tried to see them as I had seen them when Marduk was with me. And for a moment I did. I saw them as wraiths throughout the room, sort of shuffling and mumbling and pointing, and then I shook my head and said, "Begone." Asenath, who had a very young voice for such an old hag, laughed at me. "You learnt your imperial ways from the great god Marduk, didn't you?" Silence from me. Then she said, "What? Won't you own up to your loyalty to your god in your father's presence? It doesn't surprise. You think you are the first Hebrew who has worshipped the Babylonian gods? The hills around Jerusalem are filled with altars where Hebrews still worship pagan gods." "Which means what, old woman?" I said, surprised at my own anger and impatience. "Get to the point. What do you have to say to me?" "Nothing to you. It's all said to your father. You make your choice. You make it. 10 years since the festival has been celebrated, but many, many more years since the true miracle of the festival has been brought about. And the old priests, they know how to do it, but they don't know everything. And for this which I hold here," and she drew a cumbersome package out of her garments, "they would give me anything, and they will." I looked at it. It was an ancient Sumerian clay envelope, which meant that the ancient Sumerian tablet was untouched inside. It had never been tampered with. I could see that. "What do I want with that? What do I care about the true miracle of the festival?" I said. My father motioned for me to be quiet. She put the clay envelope with its secret tablet hidden inside it into my father's hands. "Hide it here with the bones of the Assyrians," she said. She laughed. "And remember what I said. They will give you Jerusalem for it. Do as I say. They've already sent for me. They don't know clearly even how to mix the gold without me. I will help them, but when they demand the tablet of me, it will be safe with you." "Who gave you this all-precious tablet, Asenath?" I asked sarcastically, becoming ever more anxious and impatient at this whole thing. I'd never seen my father so serious. I didn't like it. "Look at it, scribe! Scholar, smart one," she said. "How old do you think this is?" 1,000 kings have reigned since then," I said. "It's as old as Uruk." And really, this was the same as saying to you in English, "This thing is 2,000 years old." She nodded. "Given me by the priest they put to death, just to spite them," she said. "I want to read the outside," I said. "No," she said. "No!" Then she stood up and leaned on her snake staff, or whatever the hell she called it, and she said to my father, "Remember, there are two ways to do this. Two ways. I give you my counsel. Were he my son, I would give them this tablet. I would give it into the hands of the most ambitious. I would give it into the hands of the most dissatisfied and eager to be gone from here, and that is the young priest Remath. Be clever. You hold your people in your hands." Then she turned and threw out her staff, and lo, the doors opened of themselves, and she turned to me, and she said, "You are most privileged, for I give you my one chance at immortality. Were I to keep it, were I to abide by it, I might rise above this world and the stumbling dead, with the strength of a great spirit."
"And why don't you?" said I.
"Because you can save your people. You can save us all. You can take us back to Jerusalem, and then, for that you deserve something. Yes, you deserve something for that. To be an angel or a god." I was on my feet, trying to stop her and demand more of her. But she went out directly, scattering the family with wild threats, and strode through the anterooms, and the gate opened for her staff, and on she walked, a blaze of red silk, into the street and away. I looked at my father. He sat still holding this enveloped tablet, and looking at me with large, tear-filled eyes. I had never seen his face so frozen. It was as if the muscles of his face didn't know grief or pain or fear well enough to form a face for it. He was at a loss. "What the hell is she talking about, Father?" I asked him. "Sit down here, close to me," he said, the tears spilling now as freely as they might from a woman. And he held my hand. "Will you let me read that damn thing?" I asked. He didn't respond. He held it close to his chest, and he was thinking. The door lay open, and I saw my brothers out there, all peering in, and then my sister came and said, "Father, brother, do you want some wine?"
"There isn't wine in the world enough to get me drunk now," said my father. "Shut the door."
My sister did.
He turned to me suddenly. His lips pursed, and then he swallowed, and he said, "It was Marduk with you, wasn't it? Or a spirit who claimed that he was Marduk? It was true."
"Yes, I would say that is precisely the truth, Father. I've talked to him since I was a child. Am I to be punished now for this? What's to happen?
What's this about Rimath the priest? You know him?
I don't know that I do."
"You know him," he said. "You just don't remember him. The day that Marduk smiled at you, when you were a boy, Rimath was standing in the corner of the banquet chamber. He's young, ambitious, full of hatred of Nabonidus and enough hate of Babylon to want to go away."
"What's this to me?"
"I don't know, my son, my beautiful and beloved son. I don't know. All I know is that all Israel is begging for you to do what the priests of Marduk want you to do. As for this enveloped tablet here, I don't know. I just don't know."
He cried for a long time. I was tempted to snatch the enveloped tablet from him, and suddenly I did. I read the Sumerian. "To make the servant of the bones."
"What is that, Father?" I said.
He turned, his tears disfiguring his face somewhat, and he wiped at his wet beard and lips, and he took the tablet back. "Leave that to my judgment," he said in a low voice. And then he stood up and he went along the wall looking for loose stones, for bricks that might come out, and he found what he wanted, a hiding place, and he put the tablet inside.
"To make the servant of the bones," I repeated. "What can it mean?"
"We have to go up to the temple, my son, to the palace. Kings are waiting on us. Deals have been struck. Promises have been exchanged." Then he embraced me, and he kissed me slowly all over my face. He kissed my mouth, my forehead, my eyes. "When Yahweh told Abraham that he was to bring Isaac and sacrifice him," he said, "you know our great father Abraham did as he was told."
"So the tablet and the scrolls tell us, Father. But have you been told by Yahweh that I must be sacrificed? Yahweh has come to you now, along with Enoch and Asenath and all the others? Is that what you expect me to believe?
Father, you are grieving for me. I am dead already in your mind. What is this?
What? Why am I to die? For what? What's wanted? That I personally renounce the God? That I tell the king the God has wished him well? What? If it's a performance, I'll do it. But, Father, don't cry for me as if I were dead."
"It's a performance," he said. "But it takes a very, very strong one to perform it, one with endurance and conviction, and one with a great heart filled with love. Love of his people, love of his tribe, love of our lost Jerusalem and the love of the temple to be built there to honor the Lord. If I thought I could do it, that I could see the performance through to the finish, I would do it. And you can turn on us. You can say no, you can flee. But the priests of Marduk want you, my son. They want you. And so do others even more powerful than they. They want you. And they know you are stronger than your brothers." His voice broke.
"I see," I said.
"And you are the only one who could ever forgive me for condemning him to such a fate."
I was thunderstruck. I just looked at him, at his tearful eyes, and I said, "You know, Father, you are perhaps right, at least insofar as this. I could forgive you anything, because I know you,
and you wouldn't do evil to me. You wouldn't do that.
No, I wouldn't. Asriel, do you know what it means to me that you are to be taken from me? You and your future wife and future sons and daughters? Oh, it doesn't matter. Forgive me, son, for what I do. Forgive me. I beg you. Before it begins, before we go to the palace, and hear the lies, and look at the map, forgive me. He was my father. He was sweet and kind and overcome with grief, terrible grief and pain. It was an easy thing for me to put my arms around him as if he were my little brother and say, Father, I forgive you. Never forget that, Asriel, he said. When you are suffering, when the hours are dragging by, when you are in pain, forgive me, not just for my sake, son, but for yours. A knock came. Priests were here from the palace. We got up at once, wiped our faces, and then we went into the courtyard. Ramath was standing there, and as soon as I saw him, I did remember him as my father had said. I had never spoken much with him, as he was a real malcontent. I mean, he hated Nabonidus beyond belief for not giving Marduk's temple what it should have. But he also hated everybody else. He usually stood around the palace and the temple doing nothing. But he was clever, I knew that. And he was very restless. He was young and smart. He studied us now, his eyes very deep-set and seemingly better sculpted in his white skin, and his long thin nose gave him a disdainful look. All the rest was the usual mass of curly black hair, and priestly robes very fine, down to his jeweled sandals. And then he drew near my father, and he said, Did Asenath give it to you? Yes, said my father, but that does not mean that I will give it to you. You're stupid not to. Your son goes into the earth otherwise. What good is that? Don't call me names, you heathen, my father said. Let's get on with it. Let's go. In the anteroom stood other priests waiting for us, and as we went outside we found that there were brightly adorned litters for us, and we were taken to the palace, each alone in his own litter, and I lay back trying to figure this out. Marduk, are you going to help me? I whispered. Marduk answered, I don't know what to tell you, Asriel. I don't. I can see what is bound to happen. I don't know. I know this, that when it is over, one way or another, I will still be here. I will be walking the streets of Babylon in search of eyes that can see me, and prayers and incense that can arouse me. But where will you be, Asriel?
They're going to kill me. Why?
They'll tell you. You'll see it all. But I can assure you of this much. If you refuse to do what they want, they'll kill you anyway. And they'll probably kill your father because he knows the plot.
I see. I should have realized that.
They need my cooperation, and if I don't give it, well, then it would have been better for me had I never been asked. There came only silence from him, but I could feel his breath, and I knew he was close. He wasn't material, but it didn't matter. We were even closer in the darkness of this litter, being carried with the curtains drawn through Babylon's hollow paved streets.
Marduk, can you help me get out of this? I asked.
I have been thinking of that for hours and hours, hours since your prophet spewed out all his filth at me. I have been asking myself, Marduk, what can you do? But you see, Asriel, without your strength, I cannot do what I want to do. I can't. I can be the gold god on his throne, and that is all. I can be the standing statue carried in procession. Those objects are encasements they already have. And if I were to run with you, if we were to escape, where would we go? A strange sound filled the little curtained compartment. He was weeping. Then suddenly, Asriel, tell them no.
Refuse their filthy designs. Refuse them. Don't do it. Not for Israel, not for Abraham, not for Yahweh. Refuse.
And die. He didn't answer. Well, either way I shall die, no?
There's a third way, he said.
You're speaking of Asenath and the tablet.
Yes, but it is terrible, Azrael. It's terrible. And I don't know if there's truth in it. It is older than I am. It is older than Marduk and older than Babylon, that tablet. It came from the city of Uruk. Maybe from before. It is very old.
What can I tell you?
Know your own mind. Take your chance.
Marduk, don't leave me, I said, please.
I won't, Azrael. You are the dearest friend of my heart that I have ever had. I won't leave you. Make me appear if you need me to frighten them or stop them. Make me appear and I will try. But I won't leave you. I am your God, your own God. Your God, and I'll be with you.
We had come to the palace. We were being brought in by a private gate, and now we were welcomed out of our little compartments, so that we might walk on the grand stairway of gold and glazed brick, through the magnificent veils that separated one giant room from another. And we did. We walked, in silence, my father and I. We walked, following the priest. And they took us into the royal chamber, where Belshazzar made a farce every day of justice listening to cases, and where his wise men told him, hour after hour, what the stars were saying to them. And we went beyond that into small and fine apartments that I had never seen. I saw that a seal had been broken, an ancient seal, as the doors had been opened. But the servants had come, for everywhere was luxury, fine carpets, pillows, the usual veils, and everywhere the lamps hung from the beams of the ceiling, and the oil was sweet and the light was bright. A table stood in the middle of the room. Men were seated at it. And behind them stood my uncles, two of them, including the one who was deaf, may he have no name, and the elders of Israel in captivity, and Asenath and Enoch the prophet as well. Only gradually did I let myself look down at those seated at the table, though we were being placed opposite, the servants hustling to draw back the golden chairs. I saw our miserable regent, Belshazzar, and he looked stupid with drink and terrified, and was mumbling to himself something about Marduk. And then I realized I was looking at Nabonidus, old Nabonidus, our true king who had been gone almost half my life. Our true king sat there in his full raiment, though not on a throne, merely at a table, and his big, watery eyes were dead and empty already. And he merely smiled at me, and he said, "Pretty, pretty, you have chosen one that is so pretty, pretty as the god."
"Pretty enough to be a god," said a voice, and I looked directly opposite at this fine, handsome man, taller than anyone there, thinner in build than any of us, with black curling hair, but hair that was cut shorter than ours, and a trimmed mustache and a shorter trimmed beard. This was a Persian. The men beside him were Persians. They were in Persian robes, very like our own, but in royal blue, and they were crusted with jewels and gold embroidery, and their fingers were covered with rings, and the goblets before them were our temple goblets. These were men from the Persian Empire, which was conquering us, which was killing us. All the strange predictions of Enoch came back to me, and I saw him glaring down at me, with a near impish smile, and Asenath seemed filled with wonder. "Sit down, young one," said the tall, robust man with the big laughing eyes, the handsomest man, the man who gleamed with power. "I'm Cyrus, and I want you at your ease."
"Cyrus," I said. Cyrus was the conqueror. The full details of the man's accomplishments were sharpened in my mind. This was Cyrus, the Achaemenid king who already ruled half the world. He had united the Medians with the Persians,
the man who meant to take Babylon, the man who had scared all the cities around us. This was no longer tavern talk of war. This was Cyrus himself sitting here before us. I should have prostrated myself before him, but no one was doing anything like that before anyone. And he had said in a clear voice, with an excellent command of Aramaic, that I was to be at ease. Very well. I looked at him directly. After all, I thought, I'm going to die. So what? Why not? My father took the empty chair beside me. "Azrael, my boy, my beautiful boy," said Cyrus. The voice was crisp, full of good humor. "I have been in Babylon for days. There are thousands of my soldiers throughout Babylon. They have come in by many gates over a long time. The priests know. Here, your beloved king, and may the gods keep him well always, Nabonidus himself knows." He gave a generous nod to the suspicious and dying old king. "All your king's regents and his officials know that I am here. Your elders, you see. Don't feel fear. Feel joy. Your tribe will be rich, and they will live forever, and they will go home." "Huh? And this depends, then, on what I do?" I asked. I wasn't sure then, and am still not today sure, why I was so cold and disdainful of him. He was compelling, but he was human, and young. And also, no matter what he'd done so far, he was a heathen to me, and he wasn't even Babylonian. So I was cold to him. He gave me a silent, measuring smile. "So it depends, then, on what I do?" I repeated the question. "Or your will, Lord? Has your will already been decided?" Cyrus laughed with crinkling, cheerful eyes. He had the vigor of kings, all right, and not yet the total madness. He was too young, and he'd been drinking up the blood of Asia. He was full of strength, full of victory. "You speak boldly," he said to me generously. "You look with a bold eye. You are your father's eldest, aren't you?" "For the 3 days required," said one of the priests, "he must be very strong. To be bold is part of it." "Put another chair at this table," I said, "with your permission, my lord King Cyrus, and my lords King Nabonidus and Lord Belshazzar. Put it here at the end." "Why, for whom?" asked Cyrus politely. "For Marduk," I said. "For my God is with me."
"Our God is not at the beck and call of you," roared the high priest. "He won't come down off the altar for you. You have never seen our God, not really. You are a lying Jew. You are—"
"Close your mouth, master," said Ramath in a small voice. "He has seen the God, and he has spoken with him, and the God has smiled at him. And if he invites the God to this chair, the God is most likely to come."
Cyrus smiled and shook his head. "You know," he said, "this is truly a marvelous city. I am going to love Babylon. I wouldn't hurt a stone of such a place. Ah, Babylon!" I might have laughed at that, at his wiliness, his disrespect for the elders and the old priests, his ruthlessness and his wit. But I was past laughing. I looked at the light of the lamps and I thought, I am going to die. A hand touched mine. It was vaporous. No one could see it. But it was Marduk. He had taken this chair to my left, invisible, transparent, golden, and vital. My father sat to my right, and my father just put his hands up to his face and cried and cried. He cried like a child. He cried. Cyrus looked with patience and compassion at my father.
"Let's get on with it," said the high priest. "Yes," said Enoch, "let's get on with it now. For these men, these elders, these priests, this prophetess—"
"Get stools for them to be comfortable," said Cyrus, amiably and cheerfully. He smiled at me. "We are all in this together." I turned to look at Marduk. "Are we?" They all watched me in silence, speaking to my invisible god.
I can't tell you what to do, said Marduk. I love you too much to make a mistake, and I have no right answers. Stay then.
Throughout, he said.
The stools and chairs were quickly brought in, and the elders allowed in very casual fashion to sit all about us and this conquering Persian king. This monarch who had driven the Greeks crazy all over the world, and now wanted our city, and had everything we had but the city.
Only the priest Ramath remained standing, at a distance against a gilded column. The high priest had told him to leave, but he had ignored this command and apparently been forgotten. He was watching me and my father, and then I realized that he could see Marduk. Not so clearly, but he could see him. Ramath moved his position slightly so that he could see all three of us, going to a farther column behind Cyrus, where Cyrus's soldiers, by the way, stood poised to become butchers. And there Ramath stared at the seemingly empty chair with cold and conniving eyes, and he looked at me.
Chapter 5 "Well, my lord, what do you want of me?" I asked. "Why am I, a Hebrew scribe, so important so suddenly?"
"Listen, child," said Cyrus. "I want Babylon without a siege. I want it without a death. I want it the way I have taken the Greek cities when they have been smart enough to let me do it. I don't want ashes behind me and ruins galore. I don't come with a torch and a bag for loot, a thief. I will not rape your city and deport your populations. On the contrary, I will send home to Jerusalem all of you, with the blessing to build your own temple."
Enoch now stood up and laid down before us a scroll. I reached for it and read it. It was a proclamation freeing all the Hebrews to go home. Jerusalem would be under Cyrus's benevolent protection.
"He is the Messiah," said Enoch to me. And what a change of tone from the old man! Now that Cyrus the Great was talking to me, my own prophet was talking to me. Now, by Messiah, he meant Anointed One. Later on, the Christians made a big deal of this word, but that's all it meant then. But still, it was a strong word.
"Add to that proclamation," said Cyrus, "gold. Gold beyond your imagining," he said, "and permission to take all that you possess with you, to reclaim your vineyards, your lands, and be loyal to a powerful empire that will let you build your temple to Yahweh."
I looked at Marduk. Marduk sighed.
"He's speaking the truth, that's all I can tell you. He's going to conquer one way or another."
"I can trust him then?" I asked my god. Everyone was shocked.
"Yes," said Marduk, "but to what degree? Keep listening. You have something they want, your life. There may be a way, who knows, for you yet to escape with it."
"Ah, no," cried Asenath. "God Marduk, you are wrong. There is but one path for him to escape, and he should take it, for it is better than life itself."
I realized she could see him, at least partially, and hear his words. He turned to her. "Let him be the judge. Death may be better than what you have in store for him."
Cyrus watched all this in amazement. Then he looked at the priests gathered all around, the high priest of Marduk, and the wily Ramath standing over by the pillar.
"I need the blessing of your god," said Cyrus. "You are right. You are more than right," he said humbly, but also rather cleverly, since this was just what these priests wanted to hear.
"You see, Azrael," said Cyrus, "it's this simple. The priesthood is strong. The temple is strong. Your god, if he sits with us, and I must confess I am prepared to worship him, is strong. And they can turn the city of Babylon against me. All the rest of Babylonia I hold, but this is the jewel. This is the gate of heaven."
"But how could you hold all the rest?" I said. "Our cities are safe and secure. We knew you were coming, but someone is always coming.
He's telling you the truth, said Nabonidus, and when he spoke all eyes turned to him. He wasn't addled or stupid, just very old and tired. The cities are taken. Every one has collapsed into Cyrus's arms. The fire signal towers have all fallen to him, and the signals being sent are sent by Cyrus's men to lull Babylon. But the cities are fallen, and the signals are false.
Look, said Cyrus, I'll send back to those cities all the gods which have been sent here for refuge. I want your temples to thrive. Don't you see? I want to embrace you. I didn't lay waste Ephesus or Miletus. They are Greek cities still, and their philosophers are arguing in the Agora. I want Babylonia in my embrace, not her destruction.
He then turned sharply and stared at the empty chair. But your god Marduk must take my hand, he said, if I am to conquer this city without fire. And then I shall send home all the gods of Babylonia as I promised.
Marduk, unseen by him, only listened to him and said nothing. But the high priest lost his temper.
There is no god in that chair. Our god is neglected by our king and has gone into a deep sleep from which no one can wake him.
Look, I said, why call me into this? What have I to do with it?
You have right here in Asagila the statue of Marduk that you need for the procession. You ride with him on the great wagon, and you hold his hand, and he holds your hand, and you are king of Babylon. If the priests will let you take the statue, what's it to do with me?
Have you heard some rumor, Majesty, that I can control the god or turn him against you?
You need a golden idol for your work. It's there, over there in the chapel.
No, my son, said Cyrus. All that might have worked just fine if you had had a procession year after year with the god, and if the people had seen the golden idol, as you call him, and they had cheered him and your king Nabonidus. But those processions were not held, and the precious statue is not going to enter into any procession with me now, even if I wanted it to. What I need is the ceremony as it was done of old.
A chill passed through me. Marduk looked at me and said, I know little of what he is talking about, but all spirits see far, and I see horror for you. Don't speak. Just wait.
Meantime, the priests were in a commotion. They had brought in on a bier a great heap of something, which was draped in linen, and now bringing it near to our table with several torchbearers, they drew away the linen, and we all gasped at what we saw. It was the processional statue, and it was broken, and out of its rotted inside stuck bones which appeared to be those of a man, rotted too, and half the skull showed where the thick gold-plated enamel had turned to dirt, and the whole mess lay a disgrace and an insult. The high priest glowered at me. He folded his arms.
"Did you do this, Hebrew?" he asked. "Did you cause Marduk to leave the statue? To leave this city? Was it you rather than our king here whom we have so accused?"
I understood a great deal in a moment. I looked at my god who sat staring coldly at the heap of ruin.
"Are those your bones, my lord?" I asked Marduk.
"No," he said. "And I only vaguely remember when they were put there. The spirit of that young one was weak, and I vanquished it and continued my reign. Perhaps it invigorated me that I was to be replaced.
I don't know, Azrael.
Remember, those are the wisest words I have for you. I don't know. Now they mean to put you in my place. That much we both know.
What do you want, Lord? I asked Marduk.
For you not to be hurt, Azrael, he said. But do you want to become what I am? Do you want your bones encased 300 years in that? Until it then crumbles, and another young man must be lured for the sacrifice? But let me get to your point. He leaned towards me. I forget how large your heart is, Azrael. You ask for my sake.
I can tell you this. I can come and go as I wish. I banished the last replacement with a wave of my arm, and back into the fog he went. For a mortal man to be murdered in this fancy way does not necessarily make him either a god or a strong spirit. He shrugged. Think of yourself and yourself only. What I am is what you know. Then the sadness of his face shocked me. I don't want you to die, he whispered. The high priest could stand this dialogue no longer. He couldn't see or hear Marduk. He was sputtering with fury. But Asenath was hearing it all, and looking from me to the god with great curiosity. And Ramath the Sly One wouldn't give himself away. But he knew something sat in the empty chair. He knew it. He understood something of what it said also. "You're speaking of a statue of gold," my father spoke up. "You can't make a statue of gold without my son," he asked. "The bones are the bones of the god," declared the high priest. "This is why our city is as it is, why we need the Persian deliverer. The god is old, the bones are rotten, the statue will not stand, and there must be a new god." "But the statue in the high sanctuary?" my father asked, which was a childish question. "That can't be carried through the streets," said the priests. "That's a mere hunk of metal," said the prophet Enoch with a cruel smile. "You are wasting time," said Cyrus. "The ceremony has to be done in the old way," he said, looking at me. "Explain to him, priests. Don't just stand there. Explain. And you, my brave Azrael, what does Marduk say to you?" It was old, white-haired Asenath who spoke up, stamping the floor first with her serpent staff to let everybody know they had better shut up for her. "The god says he will go or stay as he pleases, that the bones inside the statue do not matter to him. They are not his bones. That's what he says." Then she looked directly at Marduk. "Well, isn't that what you say, you miserable little god who trembles in the light of Yahweh?" The priests were thoroughly confused. Were they to defend the honor of their Marduk, who wasn't even supposed to be there? "Look, my boy," said Cyrus. "Become the god. Walk in the procession. You will be delicately covered in gold, though the old formula seems somehow to be missing." He cast a glance at the high priest. "You will be alive beneath the covering. You must live long enough to hold my hand, and to raise your other hand to your subjects. And you will live the 3 days it will take to fight off the forces of chaos. And then return here with me to the courtyard of Esagila, where I shall be proclaimed king by you. We shall do it faster if we can think of some way to make that acceptable." "Alive? Covered with gold?" I was amazed. "And then?" Asenath spoke up. "By then the gold will have hardened, and you will be dead. You will see and hear for a while, but you will die inside, and when they see that your eyes are rotting, they will take out your eyes and replace them with jeweled eyes, and the statue of Marduk will be your shroud." My father put his face in his hands and then looked up. "I never saw it done in the old way," he said quietly. "But my father's father saw it once, or so he said. And the poison in the gold is what will kill you. You will die slowly as the gold penetrates, as it reaches your heart and lungs, and then, as they say, you will at last be at peace." "This," said Asenath, "after you have been carried the full length of the processional way, gold and gleaming, raising your hand, even turning your head ever so slightly as the thick coating gets harder and harder." "And for this," said Enoch, "we will return to Jerusalem, all of us, including those in prison, and we will have the means to build the Lord God's temple again according to the measurement of King Solomon."
"I see," I said.
"So in the old days it was a real man. and when the statue finally crumbles.
"You blaspheme," said the high priest. "Those are the bones of Marduk."
This was too much for Marduk. Invisible or not, he stood up, throwing over the chair, and with a great thrust of his left hand sent the bones swirling in all directions. They shattered and crumbled against the walls. Everyone cowered. Even I lowered my head. Cyrus did not, but stared with wild, childlike eyes, and old Nabonidus put his head down on his arm as if he would go to sleep. The prophet Enoch sneered. Then Marduk turned to me. He looked hard at me and then at Asenath. "I know your wiles, old woman, but tell him everything. Tell him the full truth of it all. You know the dead. What do they say to you when you call them up?"
"Azrael, do what you want to do for your people and your tribe. I will be here afterwards as I am now, and whether you can see me then and give me strength, and whether I can see you and give you strength, no one knows. Whether I can talk to you, no one can say. Your soul will be tested by this grand procession, this fight with chaos, this courtyard coronation, this torment. But this torment will not necessarily give you spiritual life, and you may fade in the mist with all the other weary and wandering dead, the dead of the whole world, regardless of gods or angels or demons or Yahweh. Do what you will as an honorable man, Azrael. For after it is done, I don't know that even I, strong as I am, will be able to find you or help you."
Asenath was overcome with excitement.
"I would worship you, Marduk, were you not an evil, worthless god. You're clever."
"What does the god say?" demanded Cyrus. Enoch looked at Asenath. "We must tell him now what will happen to him, that is all. Azrael, you resemble the statue of Marduk. Encased with gold, you will fool all of your friends. No one will know that you are not a god. You will seem a man of living gold. And you will feel numbness and some pain, yes, the slow pain as life ebbs. But it's not terrible. Even as you walk the processional way, all your people will be preparing to go out of Babylon." "Well, it's simple enough," I said. "Let the entire Hebrew population leave now, and I'll do it." I felt a tightening in my throat. I knew that this was youthful stupidity, and that soon horror would come on me that was damn near unbearable.
"Cannot be done, my son," said Cyrus. "We need your people, and we need your prophets. We need them proclaiming Cyrus the Persian is the anointed of your God. We need all the city to roar in one voice, and I will not deceive you. I don't believe in your God, Marduk, and I don't believe that you will become a god if you do this."
"Tell him all of it," said Marduk.
"Not now, and that part doesn't matter," said Asenath. "He may say no to that, you know as well as I do."
"Azrael," Marduk said, turning to me and embracing me, "I love you. I will be with you in the procession. They are speaking the truth. They will let your people go. I can stand this mortal company no longer. Asenath, be kind to the dead whom you call so often, for they are desperate to be near to life, you know. Desperate."
"I know, God of the heathens," she said. "Will you come to me now and talk to me?"
"Never!"
screamed the high priest. Then he quieted down. He looked at two other priests, men I scarcely remember. It was Ramath, the sly one, who spoke up. "She is the only one who knows how to mix the gold, remember?" I laughed. I couldn't stop myself. I laughed.
"Ah, I see," said Cyrus.
"So you turn to the Canaanite sorceress because your own wise men no longer know the secret." My laughter, unshared, finally left me in peace. It took great courage for me to turn to my father. He sat as one broken and finished, his eyes wet and his face still.
you might have thought I was already buried.
You must come too, Father, you and all my brothers.
Oh, Azrael.
No, that's the last thing I ask of you, Father.
Come.
When we are led down the processional way, let me see your upturned face and the faces of my family. That is, of course, if you believe in these men and you believe in this proclamation.
Money has already changed hands, said Cyrus. Messengers are already on the way to Jerusalem. Your family will be great among the tribe, and you will be remembered for your sacrifice.
Like hell, great king, I said. Hebrews don't remember those who pretend to be Babylonian gods. But I'll do it. I'll do it because my father wants me to do it. And I forgive him. My father looked at me. His eyes said it all, his love, his broken heart. Then he looked at Enoch and Asenath and the elders of our tribe, who had sat silent all this while. And then he said in the simplest words, I love you, my son.
Father, I want you to know this, I said. There is another reason why I do this. I do it for you, for our people, for Jerusalem, and because I have talked with a God himself. But I do it for one more reason, and that is simple. I wouldn't have anyone else suffer this. I wouldn't wish it on another.
Surely there was vanity in my words, but no one seemed to think so. Or if they did, they forgave it. The elders rose. They had their proclamation in their hands. All were satisfied. It was done. Cyrus the Persian was the Messiah.
Tomorrow morning the trumpets sound, said the high priest. It will be announced that Marduk has brought Cyrus to liberate us from Nabonidus. The processional way is already being prepared. By the time the sun is high, everyone will be in the street. The boat waits in the river to take us to the garden house where you will slay the dragon Tiamat. And that, by the way, will be nothing to you. We will return the following day with you. We will hold you and do all we can to ease your pain.
On the third morning, in the courtyard, you must have life enough in you to rise and to put the crown on the head of Cyrus. That is all. After that you may stand, held straight by the goal that kills you, warmed by it, numbed by it, and you may die in it. All the rest, the reading of the poems, the destinies, all you need do is keep your eyes fixed and open.
And if I don't make the 3 days?
You will. The others always did. It is after that we may have to ease your death with a little more of the gold, perhaps, in your mouth. But it will be painless.
I'm sure, I said.
Do you know how I despise you?
I do not care, said the high priest.
You're a Hebrew. You never loved me. You never loved our God.
Oh, but he does, said Asenath. That is the pity.
But don't fear, Azrael. Your sacrifice is so great for Israel that the Lord God of hosts will forgive you, and your flame will be joined in death with the great fire that he is.
I vow it, said Enoch.
I laughed contemptuously. I looked up, meaning only to look away in disdain. But I could see now that the room was thick with spirits. Like smoke, they hovered all around, ghosts. I didn't know what they were or had been. Their clothes were gone to such simplicity. Nothing remained except a tunic here or a robe there. Sometimes there was not even a real form, only a face looking at me.
"What is it, son?" asked Cyrus kindly.
"Nothing. Only I see the lost souls, and I hope that I do find rest in the fire of my God. But it's foolish to even think of it."
"Leave us now, all of you. Leave the boy with us," said Ramath. "We must groom him and dress him to be the finest Marduk who has ever been carried down the processional way. And you, old woman, will keep your promise, and tell us how to mix the gold and how to put the gold on him, on his skin, his hair, his clothes. "'Go on, Father,' I said. "'But do let me see you tomorrow. "'Know that I love you. "'Know that I forgive you. "'Make of us a powerful house, Father. "'Make of us a powerful nation.' "'I bent over and kissed him hard on the mouth and on both cheeks, "'and then I looked to King Cyrus. "'After all, he had not dismissed me. "'But my father left, and the priests took out old Nabonidus, "'who had in fact fallen asleep, "'and the miserable, mumbling Belshazzar, "'who was drunk and confused and seemed ready at any moment to be murdered. "'I didn't care what happened to either of them.' I listened to my father's steps until I couldn't hear them any more. Enoch went out with the elders, making some big fine speech then, of which I don't remember a single word, except that it sounded like a bad imitation of Samuel. Cyrus stared at me. His eyes spoke. They spoke respect. They spoke forgiveness for my rudeness, my lack of servility, my lack of courtesy. "'There are worse ways to die,' said the high priest. You will be surrounded by those who worship you. As your vision dims, you will see rose petals fall before you. You will see a king kneel at your feet. We need to take him now, said Ramath. Cyrus beckoned for me to come to him. I stood up, went round the table, and bent down to receive his embrace. And he rose with me, embracing me man to man. Hold my hand for those 3 days, my son. Hold steady, and I promise you, Israel will live under me forever in peace, as long as there is Cyrus and Persia, and Yahweh will have his temple. You are braver than I am, son, and I consider myself the bravest man in the world, you know. But you are braver. Now go, and tomorrow we will begin our journey together. You have my love. You have my unbounded love, the love of a king who was a king before he came to you, and will be a greater king because of you. Thank you, my lord, I said. Be good to my people. I am a poor spokesman for my God, but he is powerful. I honor him, said Cyrus, and all the beliefs and all the gods of those I take under my protection. Good night, child. Good night. He turned, and his soldiers closed in around him, and he walked very straight and calm out of the chamber. No one remained now but me and the priests and Asenath. I looked about. The dead had faded. But Marduk had come back and watched with folded arms. Marduk had sent them scurrying, perhaps. "Parting words for me," I said. "I'll be with you," he said. I shall use all my power to be with you and ease your pain and help you. As I told you, I remember nothing of any such procession, or birth, or death. And maybe when your flame has gone into the great fire of your God, I will be here still for Babylon. If you love your people so much, maybe I can love my people a little more. Oh, you needn't doubt him. He's a fine demon, said Asenath. Marduk glared at her and disappeared. The old priest raised his hand as if he would strike her, and she laughed in his face. "'You can't do this without me, you fool,' she said, "'and you had better write down everything I tell you. You're a